Welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, the place where you're in the know. You can find us online at commonwealthclub.org, on Facebook, Twitter, and our YouTube channel. I'm Gloria Duffy, President and CEO of the Commonwealth Club, and I'll be our moderator for tonight's program. Against a backdrop of the just-completed presidential elections in Ukraine, while violent skirmishes continue in the eastern part of Ukraine, and the U.S. and Russia are at loggerheads over the situation, I'm pleased to introduce our distinguished speaker to illuminate this difficult situation for us. Dr. Michael McFaul is currently the Peter and Helen Bing Senior Fellow at the Hoover Institution, where he co-directs the Iran Democracy Project. He's also a professor of political science and CSAC-affiliated faculty member at Stanford University. He has served in many prior positions at Stanford, including as the director of the Center on Democracy, Development, and the Rule of Law and deputy director of the Freeman Spogli Institute at Stanford University. In 2011, President Obama nominated Dr. McFaul to be United States Ambassador to Russia. The United States Senate confirmed him by unanimous consent. Dr. McFaul became only the second non-career diplomat in 30 years to be U.S. Ambassador to Russia. During his distinguished three-year tenure, Ambassador McFaul was instrumental in concluding the New START Accord, limiting nuclear arms, in the opening of the Northern Distribution Network, allowing the United States to send supplies to its troops in Afghanistan by way of Russia. He was instrumental in U.S.-Russian cooperation both on Iran and North Korea, and in Russia's accession to the World Trade Organization, which the U.S. has wanted as a matter of policy. Dr. McFaul announced his resignation from his posting to Russia on February 4, 2014, to be effective after the Sochi Olympics, citing in part the difficulty of his 5,600-mile commute to see his family who had already departed for Palo Alto. The White House's choice of a successor has been delayed because of the Crimean crisis, so the post is currently unfilled. Prior to his nomination to the ambassadorial position, Dr. McFaul worked at the U.S. National Security Council as special assistant to the president and senior director for Russian and Eurasian affairs. He was born in Glasgow, Montana, and raised in Butte and Bozeman, Montana. He earned a BA in International Relations and Slavic Languages and an MA in Slavic and East European Studies from Stanford University in 1986, and then began spending time in the then Soviet Union as a student, first in the summer of 1983 studying Russian at what's now St. Petersburg State University, and then a semester in 1985 at Moscow State University. He won a Rhodes Scholarship, and he earned his DPhil in International Relations from Oxford University in 1991. He is the author and editor of many papers and monographs, including Revolution in Orange, The Origins of Ukraine's Democratic Breakthrough, Between Dictatorship and Democracy, Russian Post-Communist Political Reform, After the Collapse of Communism, Comparative Lessons of Transitions, Popular Choice and Managed Democracy, the Russian Elections of 1999 and 2000, and many others. He has served on the editorial boards of Current History, the Journal of Democracy, Perspectives on European Politics and Society, Post-Soviet Affairs, and the Washington Quarterly. As my longtime acquaintance and colleague, what I most respect about Dr. McFaul is his willingness to speak the truth, even when it's awkward, especially when it comes to Russian policies or policies of other countries where freedoms are denied to their own citizens. Please welcome Ambassador Mike McFaul.
Thank you. Thank you. Great to be back. The last time I was here, I was a surrogate for then-candidate Obama in a discussion back in 2008. And as I was driving up here, I was thinking, first of all, what went wrong in U.S.-Russian relations? And then thinking about where are we at in terms of our foreign policy more generally. I'm going to leave that second topic to the president tomorrow because he's going to give a big speech about it on West Point. So if you're interested in that, I highly encourage you to tune into that speech. But with respect to Russia, it did, and thank you for listing all of our accomplishments, by the way. That was great, Gloria, because we did get a lot done in the first years that I was in the government under the slogan and policy called Reset. And so my question as I was driving up today is, like, what happened? What happened? Why are we where we're at today in a period that I consider to be the most confrontational period in U.S.-Russian relations since most certainly the Cold War? And I think you actually have to go back pretty deep into the Cold War to remember an analogous period that we're in today. So I don't want to spend too much time initially. I know there's going to be lots of questions about Poroshenko and the People's Republic of Donetsk. They don't call it that, but that's what I call it. We're going to get to that, I'm sure. But I wanted to spend 15 or 20 minutes to ask the kind of big question. What happened? Why did we get here? What's the explanation for the current conflict that we're in today? And I just noticed, are you all looking at a screen back there? Oh, okay. Yeah, you can look at me here, too. But why are you ignoring me? I was wondering. The Giants game is on or something? No, I got it. Okay. So that's what I'm going to do. And I'm going to march through the kind of big four or five arguments that I hear out there, both in academia, on the press, and in Russia. But I'm going to tell you my punchline right now. My punchline is that it doesn't have to do with Russian culture or American culture or some kind of long structural causes of conflict between powers. Actually, I think I do hear a Giants game. But it really has to do with individuals and decisions made in a contingent moment. So that's going to be my punchline. And in academia, political science at Stanford and across the country, that's a rare argument. Because usually we want to assign these kind of moments to the balance of power in the international system, the foreign policies of countries. I'm making a much more contingent argument. And in particular, my punchline is going to be about Vladimir Putin. And that's going to be a good news and bad news story, because it's going to be a story where one person can make a difference in a negative way. But I'm going to end by also saying a different person in that same job can make a difference in a positive way. So that's where I'm going. Let me build to it now, three or four different explanations that I hear out there. The first one comes from international relations theory. The balance of power in the international system. In academia, this is realism, right? And the argument is a very simple one. It's that great powers act in certain ways, different from little powers. And as Russia has become a great power again, so the argument goes, with new capabilities, this is what great powers do. They invade little countries. And that therefore this is kind of a natural consequence of the balance of power shifting in the international system. Now, I want to be clear to emphasize that most certainly in history we can find all kinds of instances of rising powers behaving badly. In fact, there's thousands of years of that history. And I know that and I accept that. But I want to propose to you that it's a necessary but not sufficient explanation for the current clash that we are having with Russia today. Because, yes, it is true, new power equals new capabilities. And Russia does have new powers today that it didn't 30 years ago. But the notion that this is some kind of a natural correction to 1991 is an argument that is especially popular in Russia today. That this is just what we have to do now that we have this power, right? Great powers act like this. Coincidentally, but as a footnote to that argument, for the first time since the collapse of the Soviet Union, some members of the Russian parliament have called for taking Gorbachev to task, actually to convict him of treason. They want to convict him of treason for derailing Russia from its natural trajectory and its natural place in the international system. Here are a couple problems, however, with that argument from my point of view. And I want to use something that we use in academia. Notice I'm making the shift from policymaker to academia. I'm trying to use political science terms. Forgive me if I'm a recovering bureaucrat in some of my answers to your questions. But in academia and political science, we like to use the notion of counterfactuals. And it's a simple device. It's just to imagine a few characteristics in the international system being different. And if you can imagine that they have a causal impact on the way you look at history, then maybe we should focus on that. So use your imagination for a minute. Imagine after the collapse of the Soviet Union that they made the transition smoothly from dictatorship to democracy, that they made the transition smoothly from a command economy to a market system, and smoothly from empire to nation state. My hypothesis would be, had that all happened, of course we know it didn't happen smoothly, right? It was a very rocky transition. But a democratic Russia, in this counterfactual scenario that I just painted for you, I would argue would not have invaded Crimea, would not be having this confrontational moment with the United States and the West of European democracies. That is because democracies don't behave that way between each other. We don't have many findings in political science, but one of them that I think is quite robust is that democracies don't go to war with each other. Now, there are a few exceptions. I'm sure somebody's going to say, what about 1812? And we can argue about 1812, whether Britain was a democracy or not. But on average, it's really difficult to remember, to think about democracies going to war, whereas autocracies versus democracies and autocracies versus other autocracies, that's where most of conflict have happened over the last 300 years. But that counterfactual requires a lot of imagination, right? Russia's a democracy, give me a break, right? Just think about a few more short-term counterfactuals. Think about the fact that until just a few weeks ago, Putin wasn't dreaming about reuniting Russians in Crimea with the rest of the Russian Federation. In fact, I dare you to find me the speech. He's been in power for 15 years. He's been a government official for 25 years. I looked. I couldn't find a speech where he said, this historic wrong has to be righted. He didn't say that. So that leads me to think that this was not some inevitable thing that is going to happen after Russia acquires these capabilities. On the contrary, when I was ambassador, Putin had a different plan. He had a plan for Eastern Europe. He had a plan for Ukraine. He had a plan for the rest of the former Soviet Union. But it's not the course he's on now. It was to create something called the Eurasian Economic Union. This was his response, if you will, to the European Union. And he wanted to dominate the space of the former Soviet Union. That's right, he did. But he wanted to do it through this economic institution, this multilateral institution, not through intervention and military force. And key to that plan was having Ukraine join the Eurasian Economic Union. It wasn't Crimea. It was all of Ukraine had to be part of it. Otherwise, it would just be Russia with Belarus and Kazakhstan, much smaller economies. So the whole time I was ambassador, we saw the hints that they were building this. If that was the plan, then for him to invade Crimea suggests that he was using Russian power for a different means until very shortly in this transition, in this crisis, right? So that suggests that the conflict was not inevitable, that there was something else that went on in the short term that caused this new confrontation between the United States and Russia, and I would argue Russia and the rest of the world. All right, so necessary, you got to have power to use power, but not sufficient. You have to understand, well, he had a different purposes for power. What else triggered this confrontation? Second argument that's very popular. It's all our fault. It's all the West's fault. And this comes in two varieties. We did too much and we did too little, right? You can see both of those arguments out there. So let me take both of them in turn. The first argument is that we pushed Putin into the corner, that he's reacting to Western policies of aggression, of NATO expansion, of fomenting revolution abroad, and therefore he had no choice but to lash out against these pressures against his country. Now, here again, I want to make a kind of necessary but not sufficient kind of argument. It is without question that for the narrative that he's now using internally inside his country, it's important for him to talk about Russian weakness in the 1990s, Russian economic depression, and it was truly a very serious depression, that in his view, as he's now revised history, was because of us, was because of the things we were recommending that we did. And most certainly today, if you watch Russian television, you hear about two enemies from the past, Nazis and NATO, right? The two ends, Nazis and NATO, Nazis and NATO. That's part of the narrative today that says this is why we had to push back, this is why this confrontation with the United States and with the West and with Ukraine is now necessary because of these pressures. But there's a problem with that story in that it leaves out a lot of history. It first leaves out the history of cooperation between the United States and the Soviet Union, between Mikhail Gorbachev and started between Ronald Reagan and Gorbachev, then endured in the time that you were serving in the administration. And if you go back and you look at what Russia was saying then, you wouldn't say that it was inevitable that they were going to push back against these Western policies. Then there was NATO expansion. You're right. There was that in the second term of the Clinton administration and during the Bush administration. But over the last 5 years, the pressure to expand NATO to Russia's borders actually has decreased. In fact, some would argue would be very critical of the Obama administration. But in the 5 years that I was in the government, and I was at every single meeting, now that's not true. I missed one. I was at almost every single meeting between the president and either President Medvedev or Prime Minister and President Putin over the last 5 years. I don't recall in any of those meetings the issue of NATO expansion being on the agenda. In fact, we had a different policy. We had a policy of reset where we did all the things that you described in the introduction. And so just 3 years ago, number one, the relationship was more cooperative. Win-win outcomes, as we used to say, were many. And number two, even society in Russia had a very different view of the United States and the West back then. 2010, over 60% of Russians had a positive view of the United States. That was just 3 years ago. That wasn't 20 years ago. That was just 3 years ago. So to say that something that happened 10 years ago or 20 years ago is the cause for this conflict leaves out that cooperative history. There has to have had been something else that have happened for the explanation to hold. Other part on blaming the West and blaming the United States is about Obama and Obama's weakness, right? This is another argument you hear out there. You don't hear it much in San Francisco, but you hear it in other places that I speak. And that is Obama was weak, and therefore he created the permissive conditions for Putin's aggression in Ukraine. And I would just say two things in response to that. Number one, that's not the way I see it. I see first cooperation when we could, and then when we had to confront Russia, back when I was still in the government, we pivoted and we changed our policy, so much so that in such a dramatic fashion that the president canceled his summit that was planned for last fall in Moscow. By the way, a lot of wasted work on behalf of my embassy. We planned for a whole year for the summit. He canceled it 3 weeks before it was going to happen. But even more importantly, I would just remind you of the pattern of Russian military aggression in Eastern Europe. It's a pattern, and it's a consistent pattern going back to 1945. That is to say, when leaders in the Kremlin decide that they want to use military force or use their surrogates to use military force against societies in Eastern Europe, they rightly have calculated that the United States will not use military force to try to deter that aggression. Whether it's Ukraine just recently, Russian use of force, Russian military intervention in 2008 when George W. Bush was president. 1981, one of the greatest social movements, I think, in modern history in Poland, was crushed by General Jaruzelski in collusion with Leonid Brezhnev. The United States, Ronald Reagan, failed to deter that. And going all the way back, we can remember Czechoslovakia in 68, but remember also General Dwight D. Eisenhower, who ran on a platform of rollback communism. Even General President Eisenhower was unable to deter Russian aggression when tanks rolled into Budapest in 1956. So I see a rather consistent pattern, irrespective of whether it's a Democrat or Republican in the White House. All right, that gets me to my last two arguments, institutions and individuals. So institutions, the argument here is that, and I alluded to it earlier, is that the kind of regime that is in place has an effect on how that country behaves externally. And in this case, my argument is that as in times where Russia has become more autocratic, and I would say the Soviet Union too, they have pursued a more belligerent foreign policy abroad. And at the other times, and there are fewer times over the hundreds of years of history, but in those times when Russia is moving in a more democratic direction, they behave more benignly and more cooperatively with their partners abroad and with their neighbors nearby. And so most certainly there's a correlation here between the rise of autocracy under Putin and a more belligerent foreign policy. Again, when I was ambassador, Putin came into power and ran for election in the spring and then was inaugurated in May 2012. And you will remember that there were massive demonstrations against falsified elections in December 2011. And his response to that was crackdown, was to weaken constraints on his executive power, be it the media, civil society, even the oligarchs, you know, whether they're democratic or not is another matter. But their ability to influence the foreign policy-making procedures in Russia were weaker in 2014 than they were in 2012. There's some problems with this argument with respect to Putin's Russia. Number one, Putin's really popular. So how can you say more democracy means a less aggressive Russia? Well, that is true. I would remind you that Barack Obama would be a lot more popular if he controlled all the television stations, all the radio stations, and could control what I say tonight. My guess is that he'd be above 43 or whatever he's at. But nonetheless, I think it is a problem with this argument to say that would a more democratic Russia be a less aggressive Russia? I think so in the long run, but in the short run, it's not true. But that gets me back to Putin, and I'm going to end on this in terms of explanation. It is my hypothesis that the main reason that we have the conflict that we do today with Russia is because of Putin, and specifically his domestic needs for an enemy in the United States that then caused this confrontation to boil. So let me elaborate on that, and then I'm going to take your questions. Again, fall of 2011 sparked massive demonstrations in Moscow and throughout Russia. There had not been hundreds of thousands of people on the streets in that city since the spring of 1991. And there were different kinds of responses that one could imagine. In fact, you don't have to use your imagination too much. You can just look at the way President Medvedev responded to those massive demonstrations. He was still president at the time, and his strategy was, let's work with these folks. Let's find common cause. Let's figure out maybe some modicums, marginal, I don't want to overestimate it, but let's figure out a modest reform agenda that included things like developing an independent television station, including one that he actually implemented, electing governors, right? So I remind you of Medvedev's response to underscore my claim about actors, that it wasn't inevitable that there would be a crackdown because of demonstrations on the street. Actually, Medvedev had a different response. And by the way, so did leaders to those demonstrations back in 1991. But when Putin came to power, he had a very specific different response. His response was, the regime is in trouble. We are in a period of political instability. And so he changed course rather radically. First, to win the election, he needed to mobilize his conservative electoral base.
And that required a new enemy. That's us. You. Me especially, but you, it's collectively. And he shifted. And it was very palpable. I remember my second day as ambassador, I was featured very prominently on Russian television as the guy that had been sent by Obama to foment revolution in Russia. That was my assignment, according to Russian state television. And for the next several weeks of the campaign, and really for the next 2 years, that theme has featured prominently on state media, that the United States is the enemy, and he needed us to stimulate his base, but also to weaken the political opposition that he associated with us. He called them traitors. He said they were lackeys. He said they were paid by me personally to mobilize against him. So he needed us to be an enemy. And I remember very vividly at various different meetings, senior meetings and lower level meetings, when we were like, why, you know, look, we just did all these great things together. Why is this pivot so strong? And my argument was it had a little bit to do with some of our policies. I'm going to get to that in a minute. But it had mostly to do with Putin needing an enemy, needing us, and needing a more confrontational relationship with the West, and first and foremost, the United States. But I noted that there was one piece that was about us, and that is the second piece of Putin's worldview, which is that in this time when he thought that we were undermining his regime, he also believed that that's what we do around the world when we think it's in our interest. Whether it's Russia, Ukraine, Egypt, Syria, Tunisia, Libya, all of that in Putin's worldview is a master game plan that the United States is running, the CIA in the lead, by the way, in his worldview, to undermine regimes that are unfriendly to him. And that is real. That is not just propaganda. That is not just something he throws out to win an election. That's his worldview. Up until February 21st of this year, however, Putin had the ability to compartmentalize that worldview and a second set of ideas that he had about the necessity of cooperation with the United States and the West. Whether he liked it or not, I don't know. It was hard to tell listening to him. But he's a smart guy. He's a pragmatic guy. And so, for instance, for him, he needed Western investment, ExxonMobil investment in particular, to develop energy resources in the Arctic. And so he wanted that kind of cooperation to continue, even if he distrusted American intentions about fomenting regime change over here. And he had the ability to compartmentalize. I want to emphasize that in my view, he could keep those two ideas in his mind at the same time. It was much harder for us, because of the nature of our political system. It's hard to cooperate with somebody who's, in one breath saying it's great we're cooperating, in another breath calling you an enemy. Because of our domestic politics, that's more difficult, not as hard for Putin. And that, I think, is where we were at the beginning of this year. Didn't really like the way we were doing things in certain countries. Needed us as an enemy domestically, and also wanted to cooperate in limited ways, of course, in ways that he thought were in Russia's interest. And then he snapped. Then he changed. When Yanukovych, President Yanukovych, decided to flee Ukraine, decided to abandon the cooperative agreement that they had hammered out with the opposition, that's when Putin decided, okay, all bets are off. And that's when he abandoned his Eurasian Economic Union strategy. That's when he decided to stop thinking about what we thought about him. And that's when he went into Crimea. Now, notice my story is very contingent, right? Had that February 21st agreement held, this might not have happened. Had somebody else won the elections in Ukraine in 2010, this might not have happened. Had that the Yanukovych not ordered to shoot people on the streets in Kiev and created this crisis. This might not have happened. To me, all of those things were important part of this flip for Putin. Because I don't think this was a master plan that he was executing. And my strongest evidence for that is his current policy towards Ukraine. I don't see a thought-out grand strategy of what to do, particularly in eastern Ukraine. I see a lot of ad hocery. I see a lot of improvisation. And that gives me hope that the worst-case scenarios, which is Russian military intervention into eastern Ukraine, might not yet happen. So to conclude, what are the implications for us? To me, this means it's the end of pursuing the cooperative relationship that we are trying to do in the first years of the Obama administration. That's over. And it would be wrong, I think, to try to reset the relationship again, at least in the near term. Instead, what I recommend is a strategy that I call isolate the regime, engage society. So the good news in comparing our current era to the Cold War era, that Russians are smart, well-educated, richer than they were before, and more well-connected to the outside world than they were or their mothers and fathers were or their grandparents were during the Soviet era. And that, I think, gives cause for hope about why this current phase of confrontation should be shorter than the last very awful phase of confrontation during the Cold War. But it requires, I think, us to not allow Putin to continue the policy of confrontation. That means it need to raise the costs, as the administration is doing, in terms of his actions in Ukraine, and at the same time continue to engage, integrate, connect with Russian society. Because the last thing we want is for them to be isolated again and just have the argument from Putin and his state television as to the way the causes and consequences of this conflict. And I see we got to minute three, and I want to end there and take your questions. Thank you very much.
Our thanks to Dr. Michael McFaul, recently returned U.S. Ambassador to Russia. So now we're going to mingle some written questions with the questions from the audience. So we'll get some microphones in the aisles for you. And I'd like to start out with one. How are the sanctions working with Russia? How are the sanctions on Russia working?
So as designed. Okay, and let me explain that. And I know I just left the administration, and that's exactly what you would expect me to say. So let me add a little nuance to it, right? The first set of sanctions against the individuals and a handful of companies were not designed to pressure Putin to leave Crimea. I think that's a misinterpretation of what the administration was doing. And in fact, the president himself said that when he announced the sanctions. Nobody I know, and I know everybody, at the White House or the State Department, or the CIA or the Pentagon for that matter, thinks that these set of sanctions will get him to leave Crimea. But the thinking was, and I fully support it, is that, you know, there has to be a penalty. There has to be a cost for behavior that is inconsistent with the norms of the international system, inconsistent with the United Nations and inconsistent with treaties that Russia itself had signed up for. So the first piece was punitive against those closest to Putin. And by the way, for some of them, it's been costly. It's not costly for Russia as a whole, but for Mr. Timchenko, this is a much more complicated world. There's no doubt in my mind. He's one of the people that were put on the list. And his business operations have been complicated by this, most certainly. Very close friend of President Putin. But the second piece is I think, more important. When President Obama announced these sanctions, he announced this list, but then he said, if Russia escalates violence in eastern Ukraine, then there will be, and he used this phrase, sectoral sanctions. So those were designed to change Putin's cost-benefit analysis very explicitly because it was a threat ahead of time. And by the way, sanctions only work in the short term when they're a threat. Once action's been taken, then it's a very long-term process. I was very involved in the sanctions against Iran when I was in government, and the effect, the boomerang effect of having society suffer takes years. It doesn't happen in days or weeks or months. But the threat, the specter of the sanctions, it only works as a threat. Once it happens, it's over. I know fairly well the thinking in the White House. I don't know how President Putin has thought about that threat. But I would say two things about it. Number one, the first order priority for him in his cost-benefit calculations will be the military cost of intervention. And he has, I think, you know, must have a fairly realistic, sober assessment of that. And it's only secondarily that the sanctions will play. But so far, so good. I mean, the worst case scenarios did not happen. Most of Ukraine, most of Ukrainians in most parts of Ukraine went and voted and elected in the first round a president who I think was the best of the candidates to get them out of this crisis. That's all very good news. And so if the sanctions somehow help to produce that, I think that's an achievement.
I've heard
the threat of sanctions, I should say, not the sanctions themselves.
I've heard a little complaining by some U.S. and European companies about the impact of the sanctions on them. So Bank Paribas, for instance,
yep,
has bank branches in Ukraine. And, you know, there are companies, say Chevron or whatever, who are involved in Russia who relate the sanctions' impact on them. Is there any complaining going on about the impact on U.S. companies of the sanctions?
Yeah, absolutely, of course, privately and publicly. And in Europe, in Germany in particular, of course. But you have to pay prices for principles. I mean, I think, you know, when I meet with my colleagues, and I obviously as ambassador I dealt with all of our major companies and was a big cheerleader for Russian American trade and investment. I want to be clear about that. Before this crisis, it was our policy to promote trade and investment because we believed that integration would be good for Russia, good for the United States, and help cooperation in the government-to-government channel when it wasn't happening. You know, I call it the ballast in the relationship that our ties with China give us that we don't have with Russia. But when such egregious behavior happens, there has to be costs, and otherwise we're going to live in a world that there are no principles, that there are no norms, and that to me is a very dangerous world.
It seems like the Russians did back off a bit just before the election in Ukraine. To what do you attribute that?
Because I do not know, I don't think Putin knows what he's doing. I don't think, you know, you can tell the way I talk about it. It drives me nuts when I hear people say, oh, Putin, he's this grand strategist. He's, you know, he's a thinker like Kissinger. And Kissinger, who's a friend of mine, and he's a great thinker, but he is a great thinker. I think we have this tendency to ascribe a lot of strategic thinking to Putin that I don't see. But let me be clear. There are some short-term things that he wants. He wants the government in Kiev to fail. That's clear. So having these armed men roaming about, undermining the sovereignty of that country, helps that cause. He wants the Ukrainian economy to fail because he thinks that will help in the renegotiations of economic relations between Russia and Ukraine. And he's probably right about that, right? So in the first two, the short term, it's very clear to me what he's doing. I don't think he's decided what to do about these two regions in particular, and in general, whether he's willing to run the Crimea play a second time. I don't think he's decided that. And that's this wavering you see. On the one hand, he says, we have the right to protect Russians who are threatened. And then he reversed that and said, we're going to respect the elections. Well, for those armed men, that was a big blow to them that he said that. And what Lavrov said yesterday was a big blow to their cause. And that, to me, is not a grand strategy. That's tactical moves somewhat to the left, somewhat to the right. I don't think he's quite figured out what he wants yet.
The New York Times had an interesting map last week of the 100-mile limit out into the Black Sea from Crimea and the potential of deep-sea oil reserves in that zone. Do you see the grab of Crimea as primarily related to oil and possibly access to those larger oil reserves in the Black Sea?
I don't. I think that most certainly is a benefit, and it's going to cost between $30 and $50 billion to integrate Crimea. So it's a big burden for the Russian economy. But I do see this more as a flip in his strategy, and a moment to firmly put him on the course of the state builder of Russia, and then the unifier of Russia. This is now the new strategy, right? Eurasian Economic Union, that will continue. But now I think he's developed this argument, and that was the principal motivation for him going in, not the economic one.
The concept...
You realize I'm guessing, right?
We all are.
Do not believe anybody who tells you, oh, this is what Putin thinks. Yeah. I dealt with them for many years in government. I followed him for 20 years. And I'm just struck by the fact that we don't have lots of people that are close to him to understand his thinking as well as we would like.
I understand why a weak Ukraine would promote more favorable gas deals or whatever with Russia. But do you really think that a weak Ukraine, that Russia thinks a weak Ukraine on its border, a weak Ukrainian economy is beneficial? I don't think that should be the case, but do they?
Well, it depends on who the they is. I'm glad you used that word, right? Because there is not one view on this. And even when I was still ambassador, well before this much more dramatic activities, there was a real debate about whether it was worth $15 billion, which was what President Putin agreed to pay Yanukovych, de facto agreed to pay, as a incentive to not sign the accession agreement and to move closer to the Eurasian Economic Union. And if you're responsible for the Russian economy, and I know the people that are, that's a big price to pay for activity that's not going to be economically beneficial, right? And that same school of thought inside Russia agrees with you. And by the way, that was an argument we were making. Why does this have to be a zero-sum game? Why can't Ukraine have trade relations with Europe, trade relations with Russia, and everybody benefits? I used to make the argument to my Russian colleagues to say they were negotiating a new trade agreement with Canada at the time. They probably still are. And my attitude towards that was, knock yourself out. That's fantastic. As long as you don't violate WTO rules, World Trade Organization rules, and you don't violate our trade relations with Canada in NAFTA, right? As long as it's consistent with that, this could be good for Russia, good for Canada, good for the United States. And we tried to make that argument about Ukraine, and we failed so far.
Let's take an audience question.
Why do you think Yanukovych so suddenly decided to leave Ukraine?
You know, that's an excellent question that I do not have an excellent answer for. And let me just remind everybody what happened. There was shooting on the streets. Then the demonstrators on the streets started to shoot back. And there was real bloodshed on both sides. Three European foreign ministers got involved and helped to mediate an agreement between the opposition and President Yanukovych. And let me be honest, behind the scenes, we were pushing really hard for that agreement to succeed. Vice President Biden, I believe, called President Yanukovych, not the opposition, at least a dozen times during that period, to try to get him to agree to this pact as a way out of this crisis. And so when they signed it, we supported it. The Obama administration supported it. The next day, Yanukovych fled. When he showed up in Rostov to explain why he left, his explanation, I was in Sochi at the time, I remember very vividly
the surreal nature of sitting in Sochi watching Yanukovych in Rostov giving a press conference about this moment that I knew was going to ruin the rest of my Olympics, and it did. But he said that his security detail fled, and therefore he felt like he had no choice but to leave. But there's some really strange parts to that. He didn't leave right away. He went to a couple of Ukrainian cities for a while. He showed up in Crimea. I don't really understand exactly what happened there. And with respect to his security detail, we've all seen on television now, there's some very well-armed folks in eastern Ukraine that you would think could have helped him out with security if that was the only issue. So I actually think there's more to that story that we don't know. And I personally don't know, as I've just demonstrated in my very bad answer to your very excellent question.
So the Ukrainian economy is a mess. 7,000 per year GDP per person, terrible corruption. Can Poroshenko clean this up? Do you think he's the right person? He's dedicated to doing this?
I don't know. Again, I don't know.
Does he have any kind of plan?
He does. Like I said, somebody asked me earlier today, if corruption is the main cause of concern, why did they choose a billionaire oligarch to run their country, right? I hadn't thought about it in those terms, I have to admit.
Maybe he's a clean oligarch.
Well, I do think he's the best of a group. I mean, I'm not an expert on oligarchs in Ukraine, but I know from friends in Ukraine and from my colleagues in the U.S. government that he has a reputation that way. That he ran on that as presidential candidate. He said, this is our last chance. If we don't tackle corruption, we're done. And I think that's exactly the right approach. But it is a giant undertaking. The economy is not in good shape. It doesn't help to have parts of your territory occupied. He's got billion-dollar debts due to a very hostile regime next door coming up within weeks. I think I share the conventional, the assessment of people more expert than I that if there's one guy that can do it, he's the guy.
Please feel free, again, to come up to the mics if you have questions. You have to go to the mic or else it doesn't get into the recording. Would you comment on the recent Russia-China energy agreement? Is there a Russian movement towards stronger relationships with China? What are the implications for Western Europe and any other long-term implications?
Well, I wouldn't say it's sudden. This relationship has developed really for decades. It goes all the way back to the Cold War with ups and downs. In international forums, the Chinese and the Russians vote fairly consistently together, and the place where it impacted my job in the past was in the Security Council, and they're usually together on a lot of issues. Second, this deal's been in the making for 10 years, right? They've been trying to get this right for a long time. I do think the events in Ukraine and the strong response by Europe, by the way, compelled Putin to accelerate his thinking about this deal. We don't know all the terms of the deal yet. We don't know the price, but reporters out of Moscow say that they settled on a lower price to get this deal done when they did. And then third, I would just remind people that overall, in terms of the global economy, this is not necessarily a bad thing. This puts new resources into the global economy, and that'll be good for all consumers of these energy sources. I know in the long term we would like to not be able to use oil and gas. I support that, but that's a long-term proposition. In the short term, we need these resources in terms of the development of the global economy. I see it as a good thing. Over the long term, there's been a short-term coordination of Russian and Chinese policies on a lot of international issues. Over the long term, I see conflict. I think there's a real long set of very complicated issues that they're going to have to manage. And I mean this over decades, not over months or years. The most important one is to deal with demographics and the tens of millions of Chinese that live on this side of their border and the hundreds of thousands of Russians that live on this side of their border. That, over time, is going to be, I think, a source of conflict.
Yes, sir.
To move back about 10 years, the entire world has watched, those who choose to watch, has watched the mess in Ukraine. I mean, and the only noises that we heard about this is let Tymoshenko free, and that was about all that we did. I understand $45 billion a year of trade between Germany and Russia, that had some influence on it. But why weren't we more vocal about helping Ukraine to stand firm towards democracy, and we had to wait for Maidan to happen?
You know, it's a great question. A lot of great questions tonight, and I wish I had better answers.
Your answers are great.
But the truth is we weren't paying enough attention. Let me rephrase that. We were paying attention but not following through and executing things. So I went to Ukraine in 2009 with Vice President Biden. I remember the trip very vividly. And go back, you know, you can go Google and look up his speech. And you'll see a speech dedicated to basically get your act in order. You're not dealing with the necessary reforms, particularly on energy, that are going to cause trouble for you. This is before Yanukovych was elected in 2010, right? That was the theme of his speech. I worked on that speech. And I think about that speech, and that was a declaration, an aspiration. But can I go back and say, and here there is the grand strategy that we worked with the Europeans to get them off of Russian gas and to really, that's the source of most, a big chunk of the corruption, by the way, in the Ukrainian economy. The answer is no, we didn't do that. And the explanation for it was, yeah, we're going to get to that, but we have to get through the election first, right? 2010 was the election. That's always an excuse for political leaders not to take action. Election's coming. I'm going to do all these great things, but just give me until I'm reelected. Or in this case, until this was President Yushchenko at the time, until his side was reelected. But then his side wasn't reelected, right? And then there was a period in our government, I would say, where skepticism about dealing with Yanukovych. Later, we changed that policy. Later, we engaged with him, and as I said, in the crisis, we were quite involved. The vice president really had a relationship with Yanukovych and was trying to leverage that to get us out of this crisis, but it was too little too late. And so this is it. I mean, I really do believe, and my colleagues at the World Bank and the IMF and the American government do believe that this is it. You know, this is three strikes and you're out. There won't be another $18 billion IMF package if they squander this opportunity.
And the you're out part may also include further Russian encroachment into Ukraine and the U.S. not feeling that it can do much of anything.
That's right. I mean, I think the strategy is to remind Putin of the costs of further escalation, but realizing that if he does take that step, there's no real military option on the table, to the best of my knowledge.
Yes, ma'am.
Hello. I'm actually originally from Ukraine, so I'm kind of following up on the entire conversation. So what's going to happen with Ukraine and
Speak
Ukrainian...
Speak into the mic a little. Yeah, there you go.
So what do you see is going to happen with Ukraine and Ukrainian people, given the fact that the country is very weak and it's surrounded or it's neighboring with very strong and military Russia, and the Western world isn't really going to help?
it's a moment of truth for Ukraine. I mean, this is it. And I'm optimistic, by the way. I'm optimistic because the negative story is all the structural factors that we know and we've just discussed in terms of the economy. The positive story is that Ukrainian national identity is stronger today than ever before because of the tragedy, right? So sometimes it takes a crisis to awaken a society. Most certainly I would say that's true in our history in terms of foreign policy challenges we've had before. Now Ukraine has a real foreign policy challenge, and just to muddle along is not sufficient. And I can't predict what's going to happen because the challenges are dire. But I can tell you from my Ukrainian friends that I respect in civil society, journalists, and business people, that they do see that this is a moment now where they really have to take on the hard things. And because if they don't, there may not be a Ukraine. I mean, that's really literally the kind of stakes that they are struggling with.
You mentioned trying to engage with the Russian people. It seems like to me that there's also an opportunity to engage with Ukraine in terms of helping them increase the rule of law and come up with the institutions for civil society that will combat the corruption. You're probably involved in some of that. CDDRL, I'm sure, is involved with that. Can you say a little bit about that? What can organizations and people in the U.S. do to help with this sort of last chance in Ukraine?
Well, the truth is that USAID and all of its affiliated organizations have been active in Ukraine for a long time and have done good work. They've done some very good things. But you can't want it more than your partner. And this is kind of a problem, I would say, I come out of the government more sober about than I was when I was just a noodlehead academic. Now I'm a noodlehead academic again, but we think we're engineers. You know, we think we can go, we got a problem, there's a problem in the world, we can go solve it. And some problems we can't solve, number one. And number two, I think we sometimes underestimate or overestimate our ability to get others to do what we see is in their interest, but they actually see it a different way, right? But this moment I do think is different. I think there is this demand. There's a spirit. One of my former colleagues in Ukraine, who's an ethnic Russian from Crimea, by the way, she was describing it to me in an email a couple weeks ago. She said, this is our moment. She's younger, right? She's 25, 26. And she said, this is our moment now to prove that we can do it. And so that's different, right? Before, they were waiting for these other people to do it, right? Yushchenko, Timoshenko, the leaders of the Orange Revolution. She was like, no, this is our time. And I thought that was an interesting way to phrase it. I don't know what that means in reality. But that then creates willing interlocutors for groups like NDI and IRI and the groups that work there. And we do that at Stanford as well. We run a summer school at one of the think tanks. It's called the Center on Democracy, Development, and Rule of Law. And we bring journalists, NGO leaders, business people, members of parliament for 3 weeks in August. From all over the world, and we've always had really great Ukrainians there, by the way. And they go through a course about how to build these institutions. And they learn just as much from the people that come from different countries as they learn from us. It's a really interactive process. That's the bit that we're going to continue to do. In fact, I think we have somebody from Ukrainska Pravda, if you follow Ukrainian journalism coming to participate this year.
And for our listeners on the radio and viewers on television and the internet, this is the Commonwealth Club of California's broadcast. And this evening we are hosting Ambassador Michael McFaul, former U.S. ambassador to Russia, and we're talking about the situation in Ukraine, Crimea, and Russia currently. Yes, sir.
Not so long ago, I heard the Premier of Russia complaining about American foreign policy and some of the transgressions that we have committed in this world, from installing the Shah of Iran to invading Iraq. My question is, everybody makes mistakes, and would not we have an advantage if we could learn to own some of our own before we start passing judgment on him, if we expect reciprocity from him in his behavior?
Yes. The answer to that is yes. In fact, I wrote almost as much in a New York Times piece I did a couple months ago about how to respond. But two wrongs don't make a right. You can't say, well, I have to invade Crimea because you invaded Iraq. That logic is, I don't understand that logic. And moreover, if you were against the war in Iraq, as President Putin was, then how can you be against it then, but now for this intervention, just to say, well, that's because you did that. That makes no sense to me. Second, the decision to invade Iraq, it was a very controversial one. Obviously, President Obama didn't support that. It's the reason he's president, is that he didn't support that, I think. But we just had President Bush recently down at Stanford, and I think it's important in their defense to realize that there was a much more international support even for that war that half of America didn't support, and Senator Obama and later President Obama didn't support. And he ran through the Security Council resolutions, and he talked about there was a bigger international discussion of that crisis. There was none of that with what Putin did with respect to Crimea. And then he annexed another country. I mean, let's just put that in perspective. That's a different kind of violation of the international norms that in many ways the United Nations was set up to prevent in the future, because annexation was a problem in the interwar period that many people thought we had to set up an international system to never allow again. But I think your point is right, and I'll tell you as ambassador, and every day on Twitter, you know, if you're interested, follow me on Twitter, @McFaul. There's 75,000 of you out there. Half of them are Russian, so if you don't speak Russian, you can skip those. But I try to move back and forth in between English and Russian. And your point is, my arguments that I just made to you, that I make to Russian society, every time I do, people say, well, what about Iraq? What about Libya? And it's a valid, I don't think it's a valid argument, but it makes it harder to make the case when, you know, in that context that Putin presents these kind of arguments, it puts us on shallower ground.
We're wending towards the end here, so this will be the last question from the mic.
To answer the question somewhat, we spoke a lot, you did tonight, about Ukraine and Putin. What about Putin's original play in Crimea?
What about it?
Yeah, I mean, we've talked a lot about Putin and Ukraine. What about what was going on in Crimea before, prior to Ukraine?
Well, prior it was part of Russia, but before that it was part of Turkey, and before that it was Greeks. And that's the point about where do you, once you start redrawing borders, where do you stop? That's the question, right? That's why there has to be norms against just annexing territory. And you know, Putin argued, well, Khrushchev made a mistake in giving it back. Well, so he was your leader, you know? I mean, now we're going to revise. Now he alluded, for instance, that we're going to revise what the Bolsheviks did. Even though he lamented the collapse of the Soviet Union, He now wants to revise what the Bolsheviks did in giving up these regions to eastern Ukraine, right? And it's a very slippery slope. I see my Polish colleagues here. Right? When does Poland then get to, you know, start? Well, if you're going to take that one, especially in that part of the world, actually not especially in that part of the world, in almost every part of the world, if you start going back in history to say, well, this was ours then, so it needs to be ours now, that to me is a recipe for a lot of conflict. Including our own borders, by the way, if you think about how they were drawn and how we might feel about Mexican claims to going back and redrawing borders. I don't think we want to open that Pandora's box.
So I'm going to ask the last question. Mike, what was the hardest part of your job, and what was the most rewarding part of your job being in Moscow?
I'm going to have to write a book and think about that. I haven't thought about it.
I hope you will.
Well, first of all, it's a fantastic job. I love my job in Moscow. If anybody ever offers you the job, take it.
Now might be a good time.
It's open. I mean, let me be clear. I never aspired to be ambassador. It was totally the president's idea. I never, in my wildest dreams, this was his idea, not mine, as a way to keep me in government. I promised my family to come home, and when I went to tell him that we're going home, he said, you can't leave the government. And it's a long story, but my family said it's time to go home, and this was their compromise, right, to keep me in the government. And it was a fantastic experience. It is the greatest job I'll probably ever have. Which is not to say it was an easy job, and I want to point that out, that some jobs are hard, and that's what makes them interesting. It was a hard time to be the U.S. ambassador when President Putin was launching this campaign, cartoonizing us as the enemy, and cartooning me personally as the enemy, by the way. I literally was a cartoon figure on national television in Russia. You can go to my Facebook page and see the slides if you're interested. The greatest honor one could ever have, at least for me, to represent what I consider to be the greatest country in the world in one of the most important countries in the world, with the challenges, with the upside and the downside, it was a fantastic experience. But I didn't answer your question. So the best part of my job was the revolution we had at Spasa House. When a group from Montana came, one of the things you have to do as ambassador is you have to have people like Herbie Hancock show up in your living room and play concerts at your house, right? Fantastic experience where that's part of your job. And one time a group of country western musicians came, and my father's a country western musician, and I said to the staff, to the woman that ran Spasa House, well, we should make available some space in case people might want to dance. And she looked at me and said, well, Mr. Ambassador, we don't dance at Spasa House.
It's the ambassador's beautiful residence.
That's a residence. Yeah, go Google it, by the way. Just Google Spasa House.
Gorgeous.
Take the virtual tour. It's a fantastic residence. And I was like, well, you know, and this is a really tough time in U.S.-Russian relations, right? This is in the moment when we were just at loggerheads and very tense time. And, you know, people were kind of rolling their eyes at the cowboy from Montana and his ideas about diplomacy. But I just said, let's just take out a few rows and see what happens. And because I grew up in a family, my dad would come home, and the greatest insult you can do to a musician, a country western musician from Montana, is to sit there for 3 hours and tap your toe as they play. And so I thought that would be insulting to my guests. So my wife and I started dancing, and sure enough, it took about 30 seconds, maybe 15 seconds, that 50 more people joined. Russians, Americans, Russians dancing with Americans. They didn't know how to dance very well, by the way, country western. But the point was, it was connecting as people, as individuals, as lovers of music, and all the tension in U.S.-Russian relations, at least for that hour seemed to melt away. And that's just one example, but those were the moments that it was really great to be the U.S. ambassador.
A good model for what you were talking about connecting with Russian society. We're very proud of you, and we're very grateful for your service. I know it's not easy to hold down that job in Moscow at a lot of points in time. So thank you for what you did. Please join me in thanking Mike McFaul for his talk tonight.
Thank you. Thank you. Thanks for coming.
We also thank our audiences here and on radio, television, and the Internet. I'm Gloria Duffy. Now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California is adjourned.